Accession number 4784, reel 6.
Reverend Sambash, reel 6. Did individuals themselves ever manage to contrive to make this repetitive boiled food a little more varied?
Oh, lots and lots of that sort of effort was made. The only limitation being that every scrap of fuel that could be collected anywhere in the camp, in addition to the logs that we got in, was needed in the kitchen because fuel was always in very short supply. I've mentioned about the chatty, which the Chinese use for their cooking, with little bits of wood, charcoal and that sort of thing. And most people manage to get one of these from the various sources that you find in a prison camp. And as they had opportunity, they did do their best to doctor the rations they got from the kitchen and make them as palatable as possible.
How might you be able to do that?
Well, if they could get hold of a bit of curry powder or mustard or any commodity of that nature, and these came in through the black market, well, that's what they did. There was a time when people clamoured for their ration of rice in its dry form, and they said, we will do what we think will be the best way of treating it ourselves. Of course, you couldn't do that with over 3,000 people. And, of course, the Japs would have stamped on that anyhow. They stamped on what was being done from time to time. We had to be very careful. But people did do all that they could to make their ration meal as appetizing as possible. That's how they did it.
Why couldn't you have agreed to that request?
It wouldn't have been possible for everybody to be dodging about with their own 12 ounces of rice.
Why not?
Just wouldn't work. It took the kitchens all their time, and they were in mass production with the rice and food preparation.
But one thing people had in Stanley was time.
But nothing else.
I guess it would have taken a lot more fuel to do it that
way. Oh, yes, of course it would. No, it just wouldn't work. Yes. Impossible.
Tell me a bit more about the food preparation. How many kitchens were there, and what was the setup in them?
We established kitchens in the main areas, in all five. And the kitchen would consist of a row of what we called woks, or what we would call set pots in some parts of the country, boilers.
How do you spell wok?
W-O-K.
Okay.
And these were supplied with, like some of the, say, washing kitchens that people used to have, with a boiler and a little fire under it. Well, the kitchens had a row of apparatus of that nature. And there the rice was boiled and prepared. There the vegetables, they were boiled and prepared. There the meat of the fish, that was done in the same way. And these were quite sizable places, the kitchens that we built. And they all had their kitchen staffs. And they became very skillful and proficient indeed in dealing with what they had to deal with. They certainly made the best possible use of it. And in these five main area kitchens, the whole food of the camp was prepared. And then each area had its serving area. And there the food was served by our servers. Now, we made great efforts to convince everybody that although there'd always be shortage, everybody would get a fair share of what came in and what was cooked. There came a time when our workshop was able to produce scales, and we weighed into the kitchens the dry rations. We weighed them out as cooked rations, calculated what weight or portion per head everybody was due to receive at each meal. We published it publicly at each meal, and the rule was that if the server either underserved and you complained, you could come and have it weighed, and if it was underserved, we made it up. But if he'd made a mistake and it was overserved, he had to put it back again. And there was great cheering when somebody was caught out like that. And this kept people more or less in a reasonable frame of mind with regard to the serving that was done. Our servers had utensils and servers made in the camp workshop, and they became so skillful They could almost calculate it to a fraction of an ounce. But that's how the food was dealt with. And when everybody came to know that they were getting their fair share of whatever was available, whether it was food, accommodation, or anything else which came into the camp, then we got peace in the camp. Before that, we had anything but peace. But that's how it came, and it stayed.
Where was the food eaten?
Oh, people took it to their own rooms, or went out, if it was nice weather, out in the open air.
There were no dining rooms?
Oh, dear, no. Oh, no. Every bit of accommodation that would house anybody had a crowd in. The only two public buildings, and these were very essential, was the assembly hall of the St. Stephen's Boys College. And there we had part of the school that I shall tell you about. There we had our concerts. There we had our church services. There we had our public get-togethers when the weather was bad outside. And the other place was the recreation room of the Prison Officers Club, a smaller room, but a very useful one. And you needed at least two places like that as a minimum. But as far as dining rooms were concerned, and oh no, nothing. Mm. People just took it away and eat it.
Yes. I imagine it was inevitable with the small amount of food available and that, I guess, dominating really everybody's lives more than anything else.
Certainly was.
I imagine in that kind of situation, inevitably, there were some abuses. There were some endeavours to steal or...
Oh, yes. And, of course, we were pretty helpless to deal with that because there was hardly any... punishment you could give to people. The worst punishment possible would have been to dock them so many rations. The Japanese, of course, would have jumped on that right away, and that was impossible. When everybody's up against this sort of thing, in a way, not in an abusive way, but in a very real way, they're watching one another like cat watching mouse.
Yeah.
Nobody gets away with anything for very long. And a time came when the camp settled down, as I say, being convinced that everybody was getting a fair do, then they were satisfied.
Can you remember any examples of by what devices individuals might get themselves food they weren't entitled to?
Of course, the most vulnerable people were kitchen staffs. It's true to say that we had to change kitchen staffs from time to time and have kitchen supervisors, but whose job was very difficult. And that was one of the ways we tried to keep a check on that. Many people tried to join kitchen staffs because they were almost certain to be able to get little bits of extras that nobody could keep any check on. But as long as it kept to something very, very reasonable, well, you couldn't hope for anything better. Mm. But that's the sort of thing that happened. And as I say, we kept a check on it by changing staffs from time to time or having rotas so that this week they were on kitchen duty, next week they'd be woodcutting or something like that. And so these perks jobs sort of went round. And if there was anything going, everybody had a chance sometime of getting in on it. Mm. With regard to the serving of rations, if at the end of a serving there was a certain amount left over, as there was almost certain to be with the quantities, with the numbers of people being served by any one kitchen, we introduced a system of what we called seconds. And these were done in rotation through the rooms, so that when there were little bits and pieces left over, the servers went round and gave a spoonful each to whoever was due for the next lot of seconds. And so this fairness carried on right through. And this told its tale. This gave us peace in the camp and confidence in one another. Mm-hmm. It set me thinking in these years which have gone by ever since, that some sort of system like this has got to be worked out by the politicians that everybody living in this world gets a fair share of what's in it. And there'll never be peace until that time
what
comes.
What was the situation in Stanley as regards work. You've sort of suggested that everybody had to do work. I mean, what was obligatory?
Well, now, in an internment camp, you've got men, women and children. You've got all ages and all conditions, physical conditions. In Stanley, when we came to sort this out, we found that we had only just about enough able-bodied people, men and women, to do the various chores that were necessary in the camp. And we had a camp works officer, or an area works officer, the labour officer, and he used to allocate sort of every week people to the jobs that needed doing. Everybody was willing to take their share of work as long as he was well enough to do it, physically able to do it. And that's how the work of the camp was done, and done quite happily and done willingly.
Did anyone ever refuse?
No, I never knew anybody refuse. Mm.
And what was the range of work to be carried out?
Well, sanitation, the keeping of the camp perfectly clean, kitchen, quarters. We had various workshops. We had a workshop doing the general creative work of the camp, and they did wonderful work. We had the ladies with their sewing room, and they attended to clothing, mending, and that sort of thing. Footwear, of course, was another of our problems in the camp, because anything that people brought in with them very soon wore out. In good weather, we went about with nothing on at all. But when the weather got too inclement for that, then people needed to have something on their feet. And we created a very good shoe repair shop, and they made wooden clogs. We got hold of a certain number of old motor car tyres and cut those up, and they proved to be very useful indeed as a sort of sandal. And so there were all sorts of activities going on in the camp to keep a community going, to keep the place clean, so that every man who could do everything was needed. And, of course, gardening. We needed a lot of people for the gardening work that had to be done, so that everybody was fully employed. And then, of course, there were the teachers who spent their time teaching, the medical people who spent all their time, which we'll come on to in a moment.
Yes.
Because they did a marvellous job. Mm.
And for these non-specialised jobs, was there a camp working day?
Every day, except Sunday.
Yes, I mean, did it cover... It wasn't 9 to 5.
No, every day. And when your job was finished for the day, you'd finished, and then you could take part in whatever activities you favoured.
This is the work that was essential for the functioning of the camp. Was there any work which was more of a sort of voluntary welfare kind of nature?
We had a welfare committee, and shortages, necessities in the way of clothing or anything else that may be needed, those needs were reported to the welfare committee. And as the welfare committee received anything, either from anybody in the camp who had anything to spare, or from the Red Cross organisation, as distinct from the International Red Cross, there was a Red Cross organisation in Hong Kong with a Swiss, a man named Zindel, as its head. They managed to get things into the camp, a variety of things. And these were sort of handled through the welfare committee to the people that they knew to be in genuine need. Actually, as almost always happens, we had a number of Salvationists in the camp, and they did the welfare work and did it very, very well indeed, and very fairly.
How did Mr. Zindel spell his name?
Zindle.
Just as it sounds.
We used to call him Swindle when we were a bit disappointed with some of the things we thought we weren't getting, but it wasn't his fault. He was a very decent man, actually, and in a very difficult position.
Yes. Did the Japanese ever require you to do any work?
Not us. Because they knew... I'm sorry. Right. Because they knew that we'd only enough able-bodied people to do the necessary work and chores in the camp. In the military camp where the troops were, yes, they took those out in working parties, sort of road making, road mending, various jobs. But not in the camp, because we hadn't enough people to do it.
Yes.
And in any case, they had no work that they needed doing for themselves. They just occupied their own Japanese headquarters. They had their own people doing that. They didn't want us roaming about there and finding out anything that they were doing there. So that was the answer to that.
You've mentioned clothing and that there was very little worn, but even that little presumably needed repair and replacement from time to time. Did that ever create any problems for you?
Certainly did, and as I say, that's where the ladies' sewing room ultimately came in. Through Mr. Zindel and Red Cross sources, we got in from time to time, say, a consignment of shorts that had been made in Hong Kong that were going to go out to some African tribe or something like that. With the war, they were sort of stuck in Hong Kong, and they found their way into the camp, and the ladies used to take these things to pieces and then make some reasonable, useful garment with them. All that sort of, what do we call it, recycling. much of that sort of work was done in the camp. And really, that's how we kept ourselves fairly decently covered, because when the cold weather came, then we had to put something on.
You've also said that Stanley was, on the whole, a fairly healthy place to be. Despite that, were there any health problems during the 3.5 years you were in Stanley?
Shall we deal with that under the general heading of medical care, doctors, nurses and that sort of thing, and the various deficiency diseases which occurred? I can say quite a bit about that.
Go ahead.
Well, just let me... fortunate to have in the camp the doctors and nursing staffs from the various hospitals in the colony. There was already a hospital on the campus because the prison and the prison residential quarters were so extensive and the prison staff was so numerous in normal times that they needed their own hospital. So we were fortunate in that, and we took that over and we made it into the camp hospital. And the doctors and nurses, it must be said, did a magnificent job there, in spite of the fact that they were up against shortages all the time of drugs, medicines, medical requisites. And the frustrating part about that to them, and indeed to all of us, was that we all knew that in the government go-downs in Hong Kong there were, supplies of just about everything that was needed and that would have been an absolute godsend to us. Now, we had some 40 doctors in the camp, a remarkable number, but there were all the doctors who were engaged in the Hong Kong Medical Service. The London Mission had a wonderful hospital in Hong Kong, and they had their own doctors and nurses there. There were quite a number of doctors in private practice in Hong Kong. They all came in and became the camp doctors. We had 40 of them. The result was that in addition to the hospital, we were able to establish a clinic in all the main areas of the camp with doctors and nurses on regular duty. That meant that they were able to get on to illness in its very beginnings, which is very important. And that also took a very great load off the hospitals. We had 3 lady doctors among the 40, and with having so many women and children in the camp, that was really good. And they were 3 wonderful people. A time came, of course, when the deficiency diseases began to make their appearance. Beriberi, pellagra, low blood pressure, malnutrition, central nerve blindness, dizziness, of course continual loss of weight, leading to lack of concentration, inertia, and very often great irritability. That's the sort of thing that develops. And that's the sort of thing that our doctors really paid a lot of attention to.
Did you or Mrs. Sandbash, were you or Mrs. Sandbash unfortunate enough to succumb to any of these?
My wife, unfortunately, was a victim of all that I'm talking about. And she became a patient in the hospital, and ultimately, with quite a number of others, had to come home at the end of it all in a hospital ship. When I took her to Harley Street for examination, they discovered that part of her digestive apparatus was no longer functioning, and it's never been repairable, and she's carried on ever since with that limitation which started in Stanley Kemp. It's like having a motor car with six cylinders and you've got to carry on with three. And that's why she's where she is today, which is in bed at this moment. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened, of course, to a lot of people. Well, to get down to the doctors and their attack on all this, there were enough of them to arrange for regular examination of all the people in the camp to keep their eye on what was happening, anything beginning. They weighed everybody in the camp at intervals to keep an eye on loss of weight and how great it was. Again, not being able to use what they would like to use, they had to improvise. And they got supplies of bran, ordinary bran, into the camp through Red Cross in Hong Kong. And that was mixed with our rice to be a counter to vitamin B1 deficiency. Then they discovered that there was vitamin B2 deficiency. And to counter that, they found, first of all, that the thiamine supplies that we happened to have into the camp worked wonders, but of course that only lasted for so long. But fortunately for us, they discovered that a mixture of bran and soya bean flour did almost as good. And we were thankful that we were in a place where we could get quite reasonable supplies of soya bean into the camp, because it's been discovered, as I think most people know now, that the soya bean is one of the wonders of nature. It just about has everything in it for health and growth. I mean, we used it to wonderful effect with our children. And that was the answer to that. With Hong Kong being surrounded with shark-infested waters, again through Red Cross, we were able to get in limited supplies of shark's liver oil. And that's a wonderful healing agency, because we discovered by this that bones had become very brittle. They broke very easily, took a long time to recover. That's why we had to stop football, softball, and the few games that people were playing. I mean, young men just went down with broken limbs, and it took a heck of a long time to heal. Ordinary scratches, ordinary cuts, they'd go on and on and on. Shark's liver oil was the answer to that. Of course, dysentery is the scourge of every prison camp, and we had our full share of that in Hong Kong. And again, the specifics that would have cured it, cleared it up, they were never allowed to us. But in our gardening activities, we discovered a seam of China clay in the campus, and the doctors used that as a basis for a sort of stomach medicine which kept a fairly good control of dysentery. And in these marvellous ways, the doctors kept an eye on the health of the people and did a really wonderful job.
Was there any work of a surgical kind that went on?
Yes. They did quite a number of really serious operations.
You remember any?
Yes, I do. And one of the difficulties they were up against was this. They had only a limited supply of anaesthetics in the camp, and they knew that there was no possibility of getting any more. And they were in the rather grim position of having to examine every case which needed operative treatment and decide whether it was serious enough to use some of our limited supplies of anaesthetic on, or try to cure it in some other way. If an operation was decided upon, some of them had managed to bring perhaps one or two of their instruments in with them. Our camp workshop, particularly our Norwegian friends, as I have said, did some incredible things in the way of creating surgical instruments. And with these, the doctors carried out some important operations, some for cancer, quite a number for appendix and that sort of thing, until a time inevitably came when all anaesthetic ran out and the closing stages of the camp, no operative work was possible at all. But that's more or less the story of our medical care, the people who did it, the wonderful work that they did. But oh, if they'd only been able to use the stuff that they knew was there in the colony, there's no question that they could have saved a lot of trouble and suffering that the camp had.
You briefly mentioned that you also made special medical provisions for women and children.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit more about those.
Well, shall we talk about the children?
Sure.
We had some 350 children in the camp. 93 of those were under 3 years of age when we went in. There were 46 babies born in the camp, but 24 of those were born within the first 6 months, which meant that our actual camp babies were, what, about 22 or 3, something like that. Now, from the very beginning, the Camp Central Committee decided that we would see to it that if anybody went out of the camp alive, it must be the children, because it was no fault of theirs that they were in it, whatever happened to the rest of us. And so we set aside extra rations for them from the very beginning. We established a special kitchen for the children, and that was manned by the matron and the nursing staff of the War Memorial Hospital, which I mentioned earlier in my talks, one of the main hospitals of the colony. And they did a wonderful job caring for the children. And they had all these extras that we were able to get in, particularly things like egg yolk, and again the soya bean, because they ground that into flour and made a soya bean milk, which was very nutritious indeed. And we only lost 2 children in the whole of the camp, the 3.5 years, and those 2 were lost by a very sad and tragic accident. The others came out reasonably well. And I think great credit was due to the arrangements that we made, and particularly to the children's special clinic and dark clinic, which looked after them.
Did you have any births in the camp during
that
period?
Yes. As I've said, we had 46 births in the camp, but 20 some of them were conceived outside, because, of course, they were born within 6 months of being in the camp. The rest came in the camp from the very beginning.
It's as far as the health side of things is concerned, it sounds as if the local Hong Kong Red Cross people played a pretty important role.
Oh, they did, they did. And that's why I pay tribute to Mr. Zindel, who, in a very difficult position, I came to know him quite well after the war, and he used to tell me some of the difficulties that he had in his negotiations with the Japanese. He knew what was wanted, he knew how it could be done, but he was up against the most difficult people in this world once they set their heads against a certain line of action. You can't move them.
How open was this contact with the Hong Kong Red Cross? I mean, if you wanted to make a request, was that freely available for you to do?
Most of it was done through the ration lorry, the ration truck, which did the journey in and out every day. We made that our line of communication. with various people in Hong Kong, and particularly with Zindel and with the Red Cross. We got into trouble about this later. The driver of the truck got into trouble about it too. But it was our only way. And that's how we got messages out, that's how we got requests out, and very often that's how we got stuff in.
Yes, this was an illicit form of communication?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Unofficial channel.
Yes, yes, quite unofficial. Yes. We discovered afterwards that one of the drivers, he was Chinese, we were bribing him to work for us. We discovered afterwards that the Japanese were bribing him to work for them. So being good Chinese, he was getting two payments. But of course, that ran into trouble ultimately, both for him and for us.
What happened?
Well, he was taken off. We never knew what happened to him. He was probably executed. And we got into all sorts of trouble. And certain punishments were given to the camp. And we had to be very careful, you see. And it meant our communications with town were cut off until we were able to re-establish them again, as invariably we did.
Yes. Did the Japanese take any interest at all in the health needs of the camp?
I would say no. They had a doctor who came in from time to time, but he was not much good to us in any way.
So
pretty well all that we were able to do had to be done with our own initiative, with what we worked out for ourselves.
So you had no fallback position if a case arose that you didn't have the facilities to deal with?
It was just too bad. Mm. Actually, the chief manager of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank and his next in authority, a man named Edmondson, Sir Vandeleur Graeburn, and of course the